1,000 years after that, you can see, even in the myths, that society has begun to change. And the next myth we're going to look at is the myth of Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh was a historical king of Sumer around 2600 BCE, but the stories about him were written down probably 400 years after that, and they reflect a deep transition. So at this point, Gilgamesh is the king of Uruk, one of the major cities in Sumer, but the people are complaining about him. His arrogance has no bounds by day or night. No son is left with his father, for Gilgamesh takes them all, even the children. Yet the king should be a shepherd to his people. His lust leaves no virgin to her lover, neither the warrior's daughter nor the wife of the noble. Yet this is the shepherd of the city, wise, comely, and resolute. Well, Gilgamesh is supposed to go and celebrate the sacred marriage with Ishtar, who is the later version of Inanna. But instead, he encounters his counterpart. He encounters Enkidu, who has been created by the gods basically to be a counterforce to Gilgamesh. And Enkidu and Gilgamesh fight at the very doorposts of the temple itself. And in the process of their conflict, their fight, the gateway, the temple, is destroyed. And this is very important because Inanna, who is the goddess of the sacred marriage, her symbol was the doorpost of the temple. It was originally maybe the doorhouse of the communal storehouse where grain was collected and shared out. And Inanna was originally the goddess of the storehouse and the goddess of sort of the clan goddess of our collective abundance, our collective wealth. Destroying the doorpost, I think, symbolically means that the old order, this old clan society and the power of the goddess was now being diminished. So Gilgamesh and Enkidu go off together on this quest to the underworld, and they're searching for the plant that can give immortality. And they're in some ways the first of the great epic heroes, journey, battle sorts of stories, where mythology now shifts from being about these great forces and cycles of birth and growth and death and regeneration into being sort of the hero's tale of adventures. The interesting thing is at the end, they find this plant that gives immortality, but it's stolen away from them by a serpent. And the serpent, of course, is the old image of the goddess, particularly in her aspect as death and regeneration. Because snakes shed their skin and are reborn and are renewed again. So Gilgamesh comes from a transitional time, and part of the transition that was happening was that society had become larger, more complex, had more of a social structure and organization, more hierarchy, and was focused more and more on warfare. And I think this is really the key to understanding how we shifted to a patriarchal, hierarchical society. I think it's important for us to understand today, because today, if we are trying to, in some ways, get back to or re-envision or envision a new kind of spirituality and society that is integrated with the earth, we need to understand how this transition happened. And I think we very much need to understand what are the forces that shore up hierarchy? What are the forces in society that make us believe some people should have power over others and some people's lives are more valued than others? And in ancient warfare, we like to think about warfare as this kind of heroic thing with great heroes battling each other. And, you know, if you read the epics, they focus on the exploits of the heroes and the nobles and the chieftains. But the way that wars were actually won was by the masses of ordinary people in them, ordinary soldiers in formation, basically holding the line. And that was the vital thing about that form, the chariot warfare, that old, you know, hack 'em with the sword level of war from the time of Sumer through the time of the Romans and on up. If those formations held together, then you could win. And if the formations broke, the lines broke, the other side could drive right through. And, you know, actually, if you want to see great depictions of this, go watch Lord of the Rings, you know, because all those battle scenes show exactly this kind of sort of basic infantry warfare. And you have to stop and think, well, what has to happen to people psychologically? You know, what happens to guys to make them willing to stand in line and actually have chariots thunder down on them and spears thrust into them and not run away, not move, you know, to accept their position as just sort of one of these little cogs in the war machine? What it took, I think, was a great shift in religion and spirituality, in ideology, a kind of mass cultural, almost brainwashing that's reflected in this change in myth that made obedience to authority one of the highest values rather than obedience to your own inner self or your own wellsprings of life. And it shifted religion from being about connection, celebration of life, to being about the model that supports and shores up this whole system of obedience. And part of that also was this now splitting of power, this assigning of power according to gender, so that men had this aggressive power and women were seen as weak and in need of protection. Women were alienated from control over their own sexuality because more and more women began to be used as prizes of war. That was the reward, you know, for standing out there and getting shot at and getting thrust at. That in the end, you got to loot and you got to rape and you had access to the bodies of women. With war also went slavery because it involved capturing captives. And for women, that meant sexual slavery, that meant being concubines. Rape was very much an aspect of war. And we tend to think of it as this aberration, it's this terrible war crime, you know, it's not what good soldiers are supposed to do. But in effect, it has been one of the major weapons of war from the very beginning. And so all of this, I think, is reflected in the shift in the myths. And you can really see it if you look at a myth from about 1,000 years after that, the myth of Marduk, called the Enuma Elish. And Marduk was the war leader, the chief, the king in Babylonia, and he fought with Tiamat. Tiamat was mythologically the ancient mother of all the gods. She was the great serpent whose body was the world, was the life of the universe. She was the matrix of creation. And as Marduk goes into battle against her, he wins and he carves up her body and creates the world out of her dismembered body. And I think that's a very, very powerful image for the world that we live in today. We live in a world that we no longer experience as the living body of the goddess, but that we're taught to believe is this dismembered corpse, this dead thing, this thing that is separated from the sources of life. A lot of the imagery around Marduk, too, very much reinforces that whole thing about obedience. Now we're hearing, you know, thou art the most honored of the great gods. Thy decree is unrivaled. Thy utterance shall be true. Thy command shall be unimpeachable. No one among the gods shall transgress thy bounds. O Marduk, thou art indeed our avenger. We have granted thee kingship over the universe entire. When in assembly thou sittest, thy word shall be supreme. Thy weapons shall not fail. They shall smash thy foes. So suddenly religious imagery, again, if you contrast that with the beautiful sexuality, with the idea that male power was about, you know, the vines rising up and the lettuce burgeoning by the waterside. Now suddenly male power is about obedience, about power over, about being able to kill, being able to smash, being able to win and have victory in war, and being able to tell other people what to do and be obeyed. And that is a very big shift in culture and society. And again, I think it's one that's important for us to understand very deeply if we want to make a shift in a different direction. So Marduk represents the establishment of permanent kingship, of permanent power and authority. And interestingly enough, he carries a spear that was called Security and Obedience, which, it's like he could be running the Department of Homeland Security today. It's very, very telling, I think, about what has kept people under control for thousands of years, is that need for security. And the price of that is obedience to authority, is putting aside your own needs and your own desires and your own valuation of your life. And with that, again, goes a focus, the culture's focus on war, on violence, on killing, rather than on the celebration of life and the celebration of the cycles of birth and growth and death and rebirth.